Who was responsible for the first sin in Eden? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author. We continue our series on rebellion and redemption. And my conversation partners are again Brant Berglund from the Walla Walla University School of Theology and Jennifer Ogden, Associate Professor of the Walla Walla University Church. Now, let's go to that leading question. Who was responsible for sin in the garden? Now, there are four players that come out in the Garden of Eden: God, serpent, Eve, and Adam. So how would we evaluate the, should we say, the percentage of guilt if we look at each one of those?
God, the serpent, Eve, or Adam. I would love to simply absolve God of everything, and yet there's this sense in which God gave the freedom to Adam and Eve to even make a choice. And I have this sense that maybe God would be willing to take some of the blame, but I'm not sure how far I would go with that.
And I always feel like the serpent was such a scallywag that he deserves 100% of the blame. But I don't think that that's true either.
And so where do we put Adam and Eve in the middle then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we could come down to the old male chauvinist question and ask, was it Adam or was it Eve?
Doesn't that depend on if you're reading Timothy or Romans?
That's true.
Well, there's a passage in Ecclesiasticus, which is a intertestamental book that says, from a woman sin had its beginning, and because of her we all die. Now, that gives women a lot of credit, so that may be less male chauvinistic than say, no, the woman couldn't have done it. She does not that. No, it must have been the man. So as you read the story in Scripture, where would Scripture place responsibility?
If we read through Romans and I let Paul play out the story, he would put that on humanity, that through the sin of one man, and I would say through the sin of humanity, through the sin of Adam and Eve, sin came into the world. But I have to then ask, why was the serpent trying to deceive Eve in the first place? So I have to believe that there is a sense in which sin originated in a conversation between the crafty serpent and Eve, and that's where it kind of was birthed, and Adam jumped in and participated. So I don't know that the narrative allows us to necessarily even separate them. They all end up falling into this anti-God language. Mm-hmm. Percentages, I don't know. God.
Well, of course, in the more enhanced one, we have going back to heaven. See, this is now the great controversy where it has its roots in heaven. You put pieces together and it's a very fertile field because there are no passages in Scripture that tell you directly. And within the Adventist community, Ellen White feels very creative there because there's no passage in Scripture that says you can't say that. See?
Yeah. Well, and I think within the narrative, we see the idea that all of a sudden we're trying to assign and ascribe blame immediately, right? Eve, Adam, everybody's pointing fingers at different people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's easier to point the blame rather than say, here's the big issue. And the big issue is there's something big going on and there's a battle and you're stuck in it now. So what are we going to do about that? And instead we're still kind of at the pointing finger game. And that doesn't always get us further down the road to understanding the bigger picture. And while we may want to ascribe credit to some people and some parts of the mm-hmm. story, it's easier, I think, for us to step back a little bit and say, okay, so where's the story going and which part of the story do I want to be a part of?
And that's where I think God comes in and says, look, I would take the effects of sin on myself and the separation from that sin creates, a separation from love, but ultimately no one can blame God for the sin. But he's willing to take its effects, which is an interesting thing, because he's willing to take some percentage of the blame, but ultimately is not responsible at all.
Now, if you come to the blame game that you referred to, that's fairly typical of a fallen world, if we could use that phrase.
Is.
We're constantly trying to say, well, it was your fault. It was your fault, see, not mine. And so as we look at the story, the narrative in Genesis 3, after the sin has taken place, how does God come into the picture? How would you describe God as he is depicted in Genesis 3 after sin? Is he coming in with his eyes narrowed into little tiny slits? Where are you guys?
I think he comes in like a gentle wanderer, a very curious, eager friend.
Uh-huh.
And I think he's sadly disappointed by what he encounters. But then he also comes as a bearer of really bad news as a consequence of what has happened. He gets to share with them what's going to follow.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think he comes as an eager friend, but also as a grieved friend, that he's heartbroken by the choices that have been made.
You don't see, as I read the narrative, I don't see flaming anger, but I do see, from a human point of view, something like tears on his face.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Have you eaten of the tree? Well, the woman you gave me. And, well, it was the serpent in the tree. And
maybe as a parent, I can sense that. Oh, did you really do that? I had asked you not to, and you did. Do you know what this is going to mean now? Are you aware of what consequences? This is going to be heartbreaking for you and me.
Yeah,
such disappointment.
Mm.
You really encounter disappointment right mm-hmm. off in God's mm-hmm. interactions with them.
And yet he comes looking for them.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to, but he does. He initiates where they either can't or won't or don't see the need.
Now, I had a very interesting experience with this passage in my doctoral studies, and my doctoral supervisor had been a Christian, but by the time I came there, he was no longer a believer. And he would often, as we worked together, kind of gently point out things that he thought might be destructive to my faith. And so when we were translating Genesis from the Hebrew, he said, "You'll notice here that death is the natural result for human beings.
Hmm.
Dust you are, and dust you shall return." And of course, his point was to get away from the idea of absolute perfection there. So I thought about it for a minute, and I hadn't really been faced with that question before. And I said, "Now, wait a minute. Why was death presented as a threat if that was man's natural destiny?" So then we finally agreed that man was created potentially immortal, and that way we could agree. I think many times we can agree with non-believers on what the text really says, if we're willing to be open with them. But that was a fascinating conversation. So Adam had mortality potentially, but he lost it.
See? He lost his immortality when he gave in to that which could not give life.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there's another aspect here which I think we need to be aware of. As we look at the effects of sin, I think one of the most devastating effects of sin from a biblical perspective is what it does to our understanding of authority.
Hmm.
Fear in response to the divine. I was afraid. I went and hid. And what happens to the imagination builds on that more and more and more, and you began to imagine worse and worse things about God. Ultimately, you can't really find a specific passage in Scripture that says this, but I think ultimately that means that you see the God's demanding pound of flesh, namely sacrifice of the firstborn. See? That's the natural result of sin and the imagination that takes place when you realize that, well, this guy's going to beat up on me, see?
And I have to give everything. I have to give that which is most valuable.
Yep, yep. And now we'll see that next week when we talk about the patriarchs, because Abraham faces that very, very situation. Now, there's another passage here that we need to take a quick look at, Genesis 3:15. Central to the story of salvation, the seed would eventually wound the head of the serpent. A gentle God comes walking in the garden looking for his wayward children. Eventually will bring the sharpest focus in the issues of the great controversy. But if you were reading Genesis 3 without a knowledge of the whole story, what would Genesis 3:15 tell you?
The battle comes,
and somewhere between the serpent, that the serpent is going to have children or offspring, and the woman is going to have offspring, and those two would be somewhere down the road at enmity with each other. But it doesn't say which child of the woman, but I can see how Eve might have thought maybe even her firstborn might have been the one who the serpent would bruise. Maybe the fighting, the serpent would have one child and she would have a child and off they'd go.
Well, from our perspective, our gentle perspective, and I speak as a vegetarian who just doesn't like the idea of killing animals is very difficult for me. And when I was growing up, I couldn't play with guns. My folks forbid it. I had to use 20cc syringes from my dad's office, you see. So that very pacifistic thing. And then what you have in the garden here is God providing skins for them. Never having seen death before, all of a sudden some of these friends of theirs. And my guess is that maybe the first sacrifice would have been enough instead of this elaborate system that develops through the Old Testament. But then I don't live in a culture where sacrifice, animal sacrifice is very prominent. So it's hard for me to get used to that.
And maybe we're a bit desensitized from our modern culture of gore and violence. And even the idea of sacrifice is something we've contemplated. Adam and Eve had never thought of such a thing, the death of an animal that it could cease to exist and be.
Even the language that's used there in Genesis 3:15, you know, the crushing of the head, that would have been something completely foreign and out of their scope. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I wish that we were still horrified by violence today. Mm-hmm. I wish that it was still something very strange, that we didn't hear the word homicide and think, oh, there it goes again. You know, it would be something that is so foreign to us, like it was to them. It was abhorrent.
And I think that's one of the struggles we face in our electronic culture, where you can get all of these visual scenes. And of course, it was that way when we just had TV and didn't have the computers and everything. But I remember a woman telling a story about she and her kids were going to a home where they had TV, and they didn't have a TV, but they went to the home where there was. And there was a drama on, which I think a horse died or something like that. And she looked at her own kids, and the tears were just streaming down their eyes. But for the kids who had television all along?
No big deal.
No big deal.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, Jen. I think it would be wonderful if we could come to a world where we had the horror at the right things. But given everything that's happened here, I mean, what do you do with war? See, you just have to survive. I don't think I would do very well because I'm a very sensitive person. My wife even more so. I think if we were faced with some of the issues that we have in war, it would be really very problematic for us. Now, next week, we are going to turn to global rebellion and the patriarchs, and we'll pick it up from the first story here. We'll go to Cain and Abel, and there will be a number of narratives that are really pretty tragic, but also pretty revealing. And I hope that we'll be able to explore that and find an Old Testament perspective for some of these issues. Well, our time is up. I want to thank Jen and Brant for their participation. And I want to thank David Olson, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.